Blog Talk Radio.
Well, good morning, everyone. Thank God Hurricane Irma is over. And may I send my prayers to all those in Florida, and I hope everyone survived, and to those who lost people and loved ones. We send our heartfelt condolences from Literary Viewpoints and everybody at Blog Talk Radio. This is going to be a very interesting show. The title of the book is The Binding. The author is here, E.Z. Rinsky. And when the U.S. Senator offers to have private investigator Frank Lamb's criminal record wiped clean, not bad, in return for retrieving a set of old books, he jumps at the opportunity. In the 5 years since his last paying job, he's been on international fugitive. Separated from his daughter Sadie, he's willing to do anything to return to his normal life. And I'm not going to give anything more away. So good morning. How are you? I'm so glad that you're here.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Okay, let's go to question one. This book is based on a cult, so define the word cult and how it applies to the villain in this book and why people need to be aware of the dangers of joining a cult.
So I guess the cult ideas in this book are... there's sort of an aspect of losing your rationality or grip on reality. Without giving away too much, there's a mm-hmm. kind of the book kind of centers around you know, a guy who sort of is this guy Oliver who's able to amass you know, in order to just sort of bring some people into the fold as his followers, and I guess, you know, the point of that is there's sort of a loss of clear thinking, and sort of he becomes the voice of reason instead of the voice of reason inside your head.
So the title of the book is called The Binding, and there are like several different definitions. So could you define the word as is significant to this story, and why the title, The Binding?
Sure. So I actually originally wanted to, because the sequel, the first book in the series is called Palindrome. And I actually had some other ideas for the title. It started with P, I'm not making it cute. But in the end, it's called The Binding, which is actually more sort of it's more about the binding of books, mm-hmm. not as probably most would assume about you know, some kind of like S&M sort of situation. I think there's also sort of a, I think an association with the binding of Isaac, I think, is a common association. But which I don't dislike people having that association, but within I don't know, maybe 40 or 50 pages of the book, it's clear that the title has to do with book binding.
It's an interesting fact that people need to look up to find out the history of bookbinding. That was what really got me. It was really interesting. So we have our two characters. We have Frank and Courtney. So how come they came to reconnect? And they were an unusual pair, I'll tell you that.
Yeah. So, after the first book, there had to be some sort of pretty extraordinary circumstances to get them to band back together and work together again. It's, as with the first book, there's sort of a financial incentive, but it's more about, for Frank anyway, this is sort of an opportunity to get his life back because he's been on the run. From the lamb, so to speak, since mm-hmm. what happened in the first book. And this is sort of a chance at redemption.
That's interesting. So when he was approached to take this case, to find these books, why did he decide to take it? And he really wasn't quite aware. They didn't exactly tell him everything that he had to know. So why did he take it, and what role does money have to play? I mean, people do things for money, and they don't always think about what they're doing.
Sure. You know, it's kind of funny when you're writing, as I've discovered, when you're writing a private investigator book, it's sort of, especially in this case, you know, you want them to, obviously, private investigators, Frank and Courtney, are quite shrewd guys, and so it wouldn't make sense for them to sort of jump back into a troublesome situation that they detect could go south, like to be blind to greed. It was a sort of a balancing act of figuring out, you know, what motivations could the reader kind of empathize with in terms of, you know, especially after Palindrome, just to clarify what I'm talking about, without giving away too much, you know, mm-hmm. the first time they worked together didn't work out so well. And so it was a real struggle, actually, to think of a set of circumstances that were realistic that could get them working together again. And so, this is the fact that Frank doesn't have his passport anymore, and his daughter is in America, and he has no way of getting back to America. And so this is the only way to take this job.
Well, sometimes we do things because we think we have to, even though we don't think them through. And a lot of times they don't think about the consequences, but in this case, it made it interesting. So we've got the guy that started this whole thing. We've got Senator Sampson. This is an interesting character. How did you create this character, and why at times did he seem smart and forceful, and at other times he seemed like he was out to lunch?
So, something which, I don't know, is especially probably in a lot of our minds right now, Americans anyway, is, you know, how the hell did Donald Trump get to be president, whether you like him or not?
That's true.
It's a pretty crazy thing, you know, that this guy could talk, 100 million people into voting for him. And, you know, it's sort of a cliche almost today to have corrupt politicians. You know, there's, boy, what's his name? Anthony Weiner, sort of like, you know, he was the guy who was getting very expensive prostitutes. And it's almost like, you know, we hear, it feels like these sort of things happen so often that we're not even surprised. It's like, that's what you expect from these politicians. And so I sort of was thinking, you know, who are the kind of people who are attracted to these positions of power? You know, I don't know if it's necessarily the power corrupts them. I think it's more that the people who seek these positions out tend to be somewhat flawed to begin with. And so with the senator, I was trying to capture that he has this very well-polished exterior, like, you know, even Anthony Weiner, you know, this guy, you hear him speak, and the guy gets total charmer. But it's sort of a facade to hide, like, really, like, deep weakness, apparently, in this case, and in Samson's case, too.
Yeah, well, I often wonder, I think some of these politicians think that they're immune to everything, and that because they have all this money, they could get away with saying and doing everything. And some of them are very self-absorbed and only concerned about themselves and not about the people they're supposed to protect, which is really scary.
Right.
Really scary.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting to think about less, for me anyway, it's interesting about less about, like, is it the power of the office corrupting them, or, like, how much narcissism do you have to have initially to, like, decide to be one of these people and put yourself in the public sphere and, quote, you know, devote your life to quote-unquote public service.
Well, some of them do it just for show, where they think they're on the television show telling people they're fired, which is a sad world, too. Truthfully. So the other character that I really
yeah,
like.
Yeah, it's funny.
Yeah.
So go ahead. Yeah.
No, go ahead. It's all good.
Oh, I was going to say that I started writing this book before Donald Trump was really even in my headspace, or a lot of our headspaces. And I actually didn't end up changing the character of Samson too much to reflect the current events, but I feel like there's still some nice sort of echoes of what we're all witnessing happening today in the book, even though it's sort of it wasn't directly influenced by current events.
So the other character that I like is Mindy. So why do they latch on to Mindy, and what is her strong suit? Why do they even deal with her?
So Mindy, I think, is also very flawed.
Yeah.
Individual. Which I, you know, it's sort of not interesting to write or read about people who aren't flawed. Her flaw, I think, I guess what I was getting at with her is sort of what I feel like is the flaw of a lot of sort of the typical academic who, who the research sort of takes on a life of its own to the point that it's more important than people. And so Mindy's interesting to them because she's, you know, a scholar and has all this information, but she's also deeply flawed in terms of her ability to have interpersonal relationships, and she's kind of a, she's clearly a mess.
Well, we've got that. We got to get into this guy because this is really scary. Samson is a very rich guy, but he's also blindsided in a sense. And we've got a guy that's really scary, Oliver Vicks. Why is he so enthralled with this man? And why does he think that he's so wonderful? I know he has something to do with the books, you know, but why is he so brainwashed by this guy and thinking that he's great? He's in love with this guy. Oy. It's scary.
You know, in some ways, I think, in some ways, I think that's one of the central questions of the book. So I'm not going to answer it explicitly.
Okay.
The question of how does somebody cast that sort of power on somebody else? And that to me is one of those topics that's more interesting to sort of, you know, the kind of the story is sort of set up to illustrate one such possibility rather than for me to give you a straight up answer about what I think.
Okay, so we've
that makes sense.
He's got to do something. He's got to find a certain number of books. And that this man is willing to pay anything to give them to Vicks. That's crazy. What do they reveal? Why are these books so important? And when they're not written, they're written in an unusual way. And who could read them without saying anything about it?
Right. So the idea of these books, which apparently are worth so much to Samson because he has to get them back to the guy who wrote them, which is Oliver Vicks, who's currently in prison. I think there's also a bit of tension in terms of what is the intrinsic value of these things. And Frank and Courtney discussed that amongst themselves. You know, there's a market value for them because somebody's willing to pay this much money for them to be retrieved. But you know, I think there's a sort of interesting, if I can call my, something I wrote myself interesting, thought here about, let's say, what's the intrinsic value of a book like the Bible, right? You know, it's kind of hard to judge that on merit. You know, if there weren't millions of people who considered it gospel, is that something that's valuable? Or if you replaced, if you swapped out the Bible with Moby Dick, would that be just as and had just, Moby Dick had just as many followers? Well, would the value of that be equivalent?
That's one of those. I've read every single classic in the third grade. Seriously.
Every single classic.
Every single. My teacher made me read everything. I was like, why me? Robinson Crusoe. My favorite book in the whole world is Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, The Invisible Man. Just about everything. I think in the sixth grade I had to read The Count of Monte Cristo, and we were smart. And because of it, when I taught the second year, I had the top class in the school, and I made them read it also. And we did To Kill a Mockingbird, and we read just a whole bunch of classics, and, you know, they did really well. They loved it. Of course, you know, you sort of have to push, but yeah.
You believe I've never read
Harper Lee?
To Kill a Mockingbird?
Not only did I read it with them, we did the trial. The trial is a bunch of white people and a black defendant. We did the other way because the students were African American. So we did the trial with a white defendant and a black jury to see what they would do and what they were thinking. It was phenomenal. The only thing I wasn't allowed to do is read Huckleberry Finn. I said to my principal, we're not reading it for language. We're reading it to get to understand Tom Sawyer, Mark Twain. And he was like, you can't read Tom Sawyer. You can't read that in school. So we read Catcher in the Rye and a few others. We just sort of snuck them in.
That's ridiculous.
My favorite, of
Huckleberry
course.
Huckleberry Finn.
Yeah,
is,
I know. Huckleberry Finn is no big deal. I mean, really.
How can you censor Mark Twain?
Yeah, I mean they didn't like some of the vocabulary because of the type of children that were in my class, and the kids didn't mind, the parents didn't mind, they didn't mind anything I did because I was pushing them. These were sixth graders that all scored 12th grade at the end of the year. I said, gee, what did I do right? But so let's get back. Who is Rico, and how does Vix use him to get to Samson? That was really scary. And this guy was a great, you know, hustler. He, you know, every time he talked to him, it was more money. And Samson, like, you know, plug in your brain. Think about what you're doing.
Yeah. I think there's, I mean, you know, the plot gets pretty complicated to the point that sometimes... sometimes I have to go back and reread parts of it myself to remember exactly what was going on there. But I guess the idea, that Rico was living with Samson and then saw an opportunity because he saw how much Samson valued the books, so he stole them and then demanded ransom from him. And, seems to be a pretty shrewd guy that he just held out for years until Samson was forced to call in Frank and Courtney to do the transaction for him to get them back.
Well, they accept the terms, but how do we know there's something sinister going on? When Frank and Courtney meet up with Mindy, why can't we tell that she, well, there's more to her than meets the eye, isn't there? She's, you know, not everybody's who they think they are.
Wouldn't be a very exciting book if everybody wasn't exactly who we thought they were, I guess. there's a lot of, human weakness.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff. Yeah, I know. There's a lot of subterfuge around here, and not everybody is who they think they are, but they have to read the book to find out what I'm talking about. Anyway,
sure.
And I'm looking on my phone. There are a lot of people that are listening, I don't take callers because I'm really wise about that. But this is the next question.
Okay.
Something I do know about, this is the Chabad. So why does he meet with a rabbi? What did I write? Rabbit. I have a rabbi. This is what happens when Fran has to read on her computer. She doesn't. From the Chabad, who told him that Vix is called the Sofnot, and I looked it up. His name means one who solves riddles, and yet the rabbi tells him something else. Why does he tell him something else? And I did some other research about this, too. I'm getting good at this. When I want to know something,
yeah,
I have to. It's, my mother always said, find it out. Yeah, well, this was interesting. So you can explain what you're
talking
about. Why did he meet with the rabbi? This proves
that
I read the book and I understand it.
Breaking my feet over the fire here, Graham.
No, well, it's okay. I don't mean to.
This
is because I'm a reading expert, and my mom made me read 10 books a week and take notes. This is why I do understand what everybody's reading. So answer the part you want. What does he meet with the rabbi? You don't have to answer the rest of it.
Sure. I'll answer as much as I can without. I don't want to spoil it for anybody who's hasn't read the book yet. They discover that Oliver Vix calls himself, this is kind of his nickname for himself, what he likes to be called, which is Sofnot.
Mm-hmm.
And Frank and Courtney figure out that this is sort of a biblical allusion. It's an allusion with an A, not an I. And so they kind of hit a point where they feel like this name that Oliver shows for himself must be very significant to him. And so to kind of get to the bottom of what exactly is going through his head, they meet with a rabbi in Denver. Chabad is sort of a Jewish group that sort of has international representatives in pretty much every city. And I think anybody familiar with them may appreciate the a little bit of humor in how willing this guy is to suddenly meet with them on a moment's notice, because I think that's fairly true to life in my experience.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why they meet the rabbi. And the meaning of the name is actually, I address this in a afterward postscript from the book, which is that this is sort of the meaning of the name is sort of one of the only places that I'm aware of where I sort of deviated from biblical, kind of accurately translating Hebrew from the Old Testament,
mm-hmm.
because the truth is that this name Sofnot is an Egyptian word. Even though it's in the Old Testament, it's not really a Hebrew word at all. It's because it's it was something that Pharaoh said.
All I can do is my cousin just. No, it's okay. You only give away what you want.
I'm sorry. I'm trying not to. Yeah.
No, it's okay. My cousin just texted me. She said she wants the book. Because she's listening in, and she said, you have to pay me. I said, but go get one on Amazon. She loves me because I don't ever have to buy books. I'm her library, which is great. So this is a question that's really not is vague, but it's not going to give away anything. What research did you do before writing this book? And the history behind the story of Joseph and what books are made out of, for real, binding. You can answer that or not. But what research did you do before writing this book? Because I wanted to make sure that I had the questions right, that I understood it, as we can tell. And I look up everything. No, it's great because your research was impeccable, but I've read books by other authors that I've said, like, what? And that's not exactly right. And I won't say it on air. But, I won't even ask the questions. But what research did you do before you wrote this book? It had to be extensive.
Well, good. I'm glad that you found my research impeccable. not to toot my own horn too much. I happen to have a pretty good trove of sort of biblical knowledge about the Old Testament and midrashic texts, kind of from childhood and like religious studies growing up. And so a lot of my research was sort of confirming things. I sort of would get ideas, and then I just had to go and double check that I remember things properly. The soap knot thing, actually, I live in Israel now, and there's a couple that I'm friends with who had a daughter who named their daughter the female equivalent of soap knot, and that, she was born a few years ago. That's actually where I got the idea for that. That's a little bit of a creepy story, I guess, considering what that ends up meaning in the book. So really the research was, there was research, but it wasn't by any means, like I had to learn something from scratch. It was more of a confirming sort of thing. And as far as all the bookbinding techniques and so on that I discuss in the book, there's research, but, you know, Google just makes it so easy. It's not like I'm having to sit down in the library with a textbook for, you know, weeks to find this stuff anymore. It's more like when I'm writing, I'm like, hey, wait a second, I don't know this. It's more like pulling something up on Google, reading three or four articles, and then I have my answer. The truth is, one of the reasons I think I write fiction instead of nonfiction is that I hate doing research. So the research sort of is just like, the research for me is the least pleasurable part of writing the stuff. So obviously, you have to do it, but it's not, you know, sometimes you read these books where it's clear, like fiction, where like the author loves doing research. You know, they're just like beating you over the head with all the research they did. It's definitely not me. It's sort of, all the research is sort of like, just make it sound like I know what I'm talking about.
Well, the fiction, the nonfiction, the research added interest to the story, because I think that a lot of people are going to understand better about the reason why these books were so valuable once they read the history of that. But see, what I love is looking for research, and it's probably because my nieces and my nephews call me to help them with their researches for college projects, and I'm really good at that at all hours of the night. So to me, to do research, or to just look up something to make sure that when I read a book I understand it, is fun. And I'll look about 10-15 sites, you know, just to make sure that they all, and if I find a discrepancy and something's different, I go like, wait a minute, that doesn't sound like that before. So the next question is, Nathan Neild, he was the warden of the prison, sort of.
Yeah.
Tell us about him. I'm not going to give away too much, you know, about him, but Frank goes to this prison and he doesn't realize something. Tell us about this particular unusual institution.
So by the way, I actually forgot I had to do quite a bit of research about prisons.
Oh, good.
Yeah, there's a lot of research about what prisons look like from the inside and from the outside. You know, you can watch, I probably watched dozens of hours of documentary stuff, like really boring videos that people have taken from the inside of prisons and this sort of thing. Nathan Heald is the warden of the prison where Oliver is being kept. And, him and Courtney show up and have a very tense, very strange conversation with this guy, who seems a little bit too cheery or something to be a warden and drinks heavily.
Mm-hmm.
Very flawed, character. And I think that comes through, this guy is not, because a few dimes short of a dollar.
Well, I know a lot of them do, but that's what makes it interesting, because if characters didn't have flaws, there wouldn't be any problems to solve, and that would make the book boring, because if the protagonists or any of the characters don't have trouble or obstacles, it doesn't have any mystery or suspense, so what's the point of writing the book? That would put, you know, and I've read, I can't even tell you how many murder mysteries, and sometimes they all blend in together. And sometimes I'm going to have a show on November 9th with D.P. Lyle, Mike Tabman, who's FBI, Bruce Coffin, who's a police officer, and Larry Thompson, who you know from the is a lawyer. And we're going to talk about how to present forensic evidence, how you present a case to the court, and how you follow up, because a lot of the crime scenes and a lot of the books make no sense, and they're wrong. So they're going to teach me and everybody else how to do it. It should be interesting and fun. I do panel shows ever so often. Yeah, it is cool. I just invent my own things. I could do it, which is great, because I can do whatever I want. So in this book, I get the feeling that shame, love, and fear come into play. So how do these come into play in relation to the plot, the villain, and the victims in this particular thing? Those are just three of the issues that I found. Of course, there's probably tons more.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I think I stole that from somewhere, and I read it a long time ago. I can't remember where I read it. That every crime is motivated intrinsically by shame, fear, or love. Buff with love, right? Mm-hmm. Okay. And that basically everything else can be boiled down to one of those three. And I think this book focuses mostly on crimes that are sort of committed out of shame.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that shame is introduced from the very opening scene. There's a sort of... to me, the shame is the most interesting of them. You know, fear and love are sort of...
That is true.
Sort of obvious motives. But shame... you know, I read a book, actually, that I think maybe this is where it's from. There's a book by John Ronson that came out a couple of years ago called So You've Been Publicly Shamed. It was, like, a super fun book. I mean, have had their lives ruined by online shaming. There's this woman, Justine something, who tweeted something stupid before she got on a plane. And by the time she landed in Africa, there was millions of people on Twitter, mocking her for this, to the point that she lost her job. She was like, her life was totally destroyed. And this really, John Lund is a hilarious writer. I mean, also very insightful, and he really goes into the, really makes you feel what these people get inside their heads in terms of what shame feels like. And I think I read that right around when I was starting to write The Binding. And so, there's that theme definitely pops up again and again and again of how terrible shame is and what it can make you do.
Well, before I forget, everybody, on 9/26, Andrea Kane will be here, A Face to Die For. You want to read it, seriously. On 9/27, the one and only Tess Gerrington, the very first New York Times author I ever interviewed, and brave enough to ask her by myself if she would do an interview on my show. And I was thrilled. I know a secret, and I'm not going to tell you what that is, but oh boy, the Rizzoli and Isles are really into it in this one. On 10/4, J.A. Jan's Proof of Life, and that was even scarier. And on 10/12, an interesting book that I was very nice enough to read, Ula for Women, How to Become Great and Awesome. And that's all I'll say about that. And according to what you just talked about, yeah, there are a lot of people that feel insignificant and shame. And for those of you that read Troy McComb's Surviving High School, he got panned by a lot of reviewers, and I read it this morning. I read 150 pages or whatever, and I finished it. And you know what? This is a great book for teens, educators, parents, and those bullies that think that they rule the world. This book was absolutely fantastic. T. Jefferson Parker, The Room of White Fire, a Mental Institution. And a book that I just started, which is really, I was surprised, Political Revolution by Bernie Sanders. I'll give you my insight next week. So, in relation to the books, what do they... I get everything. And, of course, we can't forget Barry Kerwin, 37 Hours on the 19th of October. My show's booked till the end of December, people. I'm working on January. What can I say? And I know I'm going to have to cramp one in for John Land, who sends Strong to the Bone. It was a prize present for me the other day. Once I saw the John Land book, I know I'm sunk because I have to finish it, like, right away. I've got so many books inside that are staring at me. They're just praying that I read them. So the books stand for something in relation to the prison. What is the importance of them? And we're not going to ask that next question because we don't want to give away what the senator thinks. So what is the significance of these books as far as the prison is concerned?
I definitely thought it was an interesting conceit that somebody, you know, this guy, he sort of, it's clear from the first couple of pages that he tried to be arrested and sort of had so much time on his hands in prison that he could write this sensible masterpiece while in there. And, I think it's, at least to me, it's sort of an interesting idea of, sometimes I think the hardest thing about writing is all the other things you could be doing every time you sit down. And so there's almost something in a very sick and strange way sort of appealing about the idea of if you were in, say, solitary confinement, you were sure get a hell of a lot of writing done. I think that's where that idea started, if I remember.
Well, who is Becky? And why is she like Vix? But we won't tell why. We won't tell what happened to her. We'll give that question and cross out. But what happens when they meet Becky? And why is she so loyal to Vix? Which I found kind of interestingly strange.
So you meet Becky. She's the very first character you meet in the book. She's the waitress, sort of Oliver's victim. And, her motives are, I think this goes back to the same question about why Samson is sort of taken by Oliver. And I think it's sort of the crux of the book is, how does one person, get to the point where they have so much influence over another person. And again, I think probably something that probably couldn't help being influenced by current events. While thinking about that, how does it get to the point where, you think about, again, Donald Trump or someone who's never met him, could have this extent, this loyalty for him is kind of astonishing. And so I think that's part of what this book explores is basically how is that possible? I think the book gets into a little bit. The truth is still something I'm pretty curious about.
Yeah, me too. I've listened to him speak too often, not much. I usually cut off the program. I don't want to hear it. And if you've ever watched The Apprentice, I wonder sometimes how all these people who are intelligent and smart allow him to belittle them and even would come on a program like that. I watched it with Arnold, and actually he's very smart, he's good, but he decided not to do it again because he doesn't want to have anything associated with him because he owns the show. So the part that I found interesting also was, how does the prologue set the stage for the story? I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah. So both The Binding and Palindrome have the same structure. That they start with sort of a, I kind of think of this like a cold open, like for a sitcom, you know, you have sort of a scene before the opening credits. It's the only time in the whole book that you're not not reading from Frank's point of first person point of view. And so that serves a couple purposes. One is that, you know, if there's any details I want to get to, which Frank's not going to see firsthand, this is the only way to do it. And the second is, I think in both books, I've at least tried, I don't know if I succeeded, but I think there's, you sort of have this event, and the reader knows this is going to end up being really important to the story, central to the story.
Mm-hmm.
And part of the mystery, I think, as you're reading, at least in the beginning, is figuring out what the hell does that opening bit have to do with what I'm reading right now, and trying to piece that together. And I kind of like that. I kind of like having, I like having that sort of extra layer, the sort of meta mystery. It's not just figuring out, well, who's done it, but also, if I succeeded, I hope I have, having the reader sort of wonder, you know, what's this, why did he tell me this thing in the beginning?
Well, let me tell you, this reader got it all, seriously. So I've read in the last week, seriously, in the week, last week, five books related to cults. And each cult leader is different.
Cults.
Everyone, cults. I mean, you've got Victor, you got this guy, and then you've got Cindy McDonald's book, Into the Dawn, where people can't be near electronics or technology. And this guy created a quiet zone for people that can, electromagnetic hypersensitivity, it's called. And I did research on that before I did her book review to make sure that I got that straight too, which I do. So, I mean, these different people are so charismatic. I mean, and you see them on television asking people for money, and yeah, okay, right, not going to happen. How did they manage to create this cult, this thing in prison, even though he's in the prison walls? How does he manage to get people to do things for him even though he's there? These people are so powerful and charismatic, and people are so brainwashed that they don't see past them. They just want somebody to idolize at times, I think. So how does he do this?
I think you hit it on the nose as far as there's certain people that sort of have this supernatural charisma. I know I've heard stories about Bill Clinton that he's had this sort of like charisma which seemed almost supernatural to people. That you'd be in a room of 1,000 people and he'd shake your hand and you'd feel like it was just you and him alone in the room together. That he had this just unbelievable power. I think, by the way, another, I mentioned in the book that I sort of wonder if that's also what some of these religious figures throughout history sort of had going for them too. I wonder if it's a similar sort of magnetic, just unbelievable magnetism that ended up, you know, causing a sort of religious or cultural revolution. Like, you know, you could read a story of the Israelites coming out of Egypt with Moses. You could read that as sort of the story of incredibly charismatic yet humble leader who's able to just influence both his captors and the captives through sheer force of personal magnetism. So yeah, that idea is something very compelling to me. I don't know if I've ever actually met anybody like that, but I certainly would like it.
Yeah, I mean, there are people in this world that just need somebody to believe in. So they'll believe anything. And if it means that they have to give up worldly whatever just to idolize somebody, it's scary. I mean, just you could read it in the news. This book could have been ripped right out of the news with what happened. Seriously. So let's get back to my two favorite characters, Frank and Courtney. I'm not going to ask anything specific. Why do their personalities at times appear impulsive, headstrong, and at times they feel like they're going to bang each other's heads at the opposite end of the spectrum? How did you create that, and then you kept my interest? I couldn't wait to see what they were going to do next.
That's a good question. So Courtney is based on, more or less based on, the real person that I know, who's a friend of mine. Frank is sort of, everybody who knows me who reads the book asks me, is Frank based on you? Am I supposed to be reading this in your voice? And yeah, maybe yes and no, not really. But there's definitely some character traits of his that just come straight from stuff I feel in terms of his impulsiveness and his, being stubborn and so on. But the dynamic, it definitely evolved into something that's well beyond anything that I have ever been a part of personally. I don't have any relationships that are quite like this. What can I say? I don't know. I've got a pretty good imagination, and I don't know. And I kind of put these two things together in my imagination, and sometimes they butt heads, sometimes they're best buds. And to me, actually, I really like the way that they often switch roles. In this second book. It's not quite as clear-cut who's the clear-thinking one and who's being the impulsive one, and they sort of switch back and forth on that.
Well, tell us about Sadie, his daughter. Can you tell us a little bit about her and how he feels about that he can't see her?
Sure. So, sort of the fact that he has this daughter and that he obviously misses her a lot is kind of one of the more human aspects of Frank. Certainly is, even in his worst moments, we know he has this redeeming quality, which is that at the end of the day, pretty much everything he does is just to get back together with his daughter. So, just from a kind of from a writer's perspective, if you're having people do kind of terrible things, it's good to have to ensure that these people aren't going to stop being totally relatable. She's a bit less a part of this book. She really exists much more in Frank's imagination than she does in the flesh. Which I don't know. I'm not sure what to make of that. Certainly, that she's valuable to me as a plot point and a character development point. But I'm not sure what it means that she was in the first book a lot and she's not in the second book that much.
So before we end, we have about 10 minutes. The ending lets me know that Frank and Courtney, that this book has a sequel, I hope, because the ending, I'm not going to say why, leaves you to know that there's more to come because they're not done yet. So is there going to be a sequel, I hope, because I have to know what's going to happen next with what they were, the other things. I said that very well without telling what it was.
Yeah, good job, Brent.
I'm quick.
So yeah, so there, I definitely did purposely leave it open ended.
Yeah, you
I
did.
I do kind of
I
know
like that.
What happens next. At the moment, I'm working on something different, which is not related to Frank and Courtney. And in fact, it's actually not even in the same genre, exactly.
Okay.
It's not really, it's certainly not a detective book. It's not really even, I guess you would say it's more of like a novel.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of needed I needed a little bit of a break from this. It's pretty, it's like a, these things are almost like mathematical in their complexity, these first two books, in terms of
oh, nice.
Mapping them out in the plot. And it's almost unbelievably brutal in some ways. Like, you change one thing, you have to change 10 other things. And it's.
Mm-hmm. Hello? The author has dropped out. I don't know what happened. I hope he calls back in. I'm going to email him. I don't know what just happened. He's in Israel, and they might have had a dropout on the line. I'm not sure what happened just now, so I'm going to email him to call back in, and we'll see what happens. I don't know why this happened, and this happens a lot, so hopefully he will call back in. Call back. And I hope he gets my message, because I don't know exactly why that happened. So I'm going to wait, because I don't know if I can call him on my phone. I'm going to try to see if I can call him. Okay, let's see. I don't know if I can, because it's a foreign country. Okay, 7 5 9 7 2 5 8 4 2 1 0 2 7 dial.
The number you have dialed has not been recognized. Please try again.
I don't know what just happened. It just did it again. I tell them to call back in, and I don't know why that's not allowing me to do it. 527-584-21027.
The number you have dialed has not been recognized. Please try again.
Hello? Hello? I don't get why this is happening. I hope he calls back again. There's something wrong with the connection. I have no idea why. There is doesn't is not letting me 972-584-21027. It's not letting me do it, and I'm getting annoyed, and I don't know why they're not letting me do it. Okay, I'll put a 1 in front of that. 1. Okay. Hello?
Hello? Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know what happened. And I actually tried to call you.
Yeah,
you didn't let me
sure.
call a foreign country. I don't know what happened.
Okay.
Anyway, you were talking about
I'm
your next
about
book.
Right, sure. So so the next thing is not even really in the same genre. I kind of needed a break from this. And I wanted to do something which wouldn't strain me in quite the same mathematical kind of crazy
mm-hmm.
intricate plotting that this is really can be pretty exhausting and so but eventually yeah there's definitely a possibility that I would go back and write a third one in the series. In fact, I probably would like to, but just not at the moment. Maybe in a few years.
Oh, that's what, you know what, you have to change up. You have to change up what you're writing, I guess. I mean, I write nonfiction, but I also, my horror series, and I'm very proud of myself, takes place from the point of view of the dead body behind the gravestone that speaks about what they did wrong. So I'm going to fight the fifth one. Yeah, it's scary. So if there's anybody that has anybody that's really gotten them angry, just let me know, because I'll put them behind the gravestone and teach them a lesson they'll never forget. It's for teens. It's for older people. The last one, Hidden Truth and Lies, is fantastic. And I'm very proud. I'm doing a blog tour with Providence Books from October 1st to December 1st. And they're taking good care of me, because guess who does all the interviews and all their book reviews? And, yeah, it's one of my three jobs that I don't get paid for, but it's okay. So where can everybody learn more about you and your work?
Sure. You can check out ezrinsky.com. That's E-Z-R-I-N as in Nancy, S-K-Y.com. Both my books, links to both my books are on there, and I also awesome musician, and I have some music videos I've done up there to check out. It should all be on that page.
That sounds interesting. Well, I was a music major in college the first time I went, not the other three times, but the first time I went for my bachelor's degree. So music, the dean said, you're going into education, good. You're going to major in music because you play the piano and violin. It was tough. But worth it. But seriously worth it. So, this next book that you're writing. Do you have a title, and when is it coming out? So I know when to ask for it. Because I read everything. And math, no problem.
Yeah. I have a working title that I don't want to say yet.
Okay.
When it comes out, I'll have to finish writing it first. And then, it's not under contract. The first books were published with HarperCollins. I would love to publish this with them as well. So we'll see.
Well, I have a lot of connections at HarperCollins. Yeah. I just have to email anybody, and I get it. And even if when I don't email them, I get it anyway. I started to do this when I retired from teaching. My mom had Alzheimer's, and my sister, before she died, dared me to do my first book review, which was a cookbook, and Fran doesn't know how to cook. She doesn't even touch an oven. That's why people deliver, and my husband cooks. He's great. So I did the cookbook, and the author thought it was so great, she spread it throughout everywhere. And after that, it's been like snowballed, and I'm so grateful to Martha Cheeves, because, yeah, this is fun. I love doing this. But I want to thank you so very much. I hope that you come into the Fuller Fest next year, because I intend to be there again. And John Land told me that I'm going to be there. he invites me every single year. And I'm the media person, the little blonde with the colored streaks in her hair. So I will be there, I hope. And I hope I get to see you again. And I really appreciate it. This was interesting,
sure,
let me tell you. And I hope I didn't ask any questions that you didn't want to answer. I tried to reword people, which is great.
No,
I want to thank you so much. And how is the weather in Israel? How is the weather in Israel? Because we're getting Irma on Friday, and I truly hope she stays away.
Well, I gotta say it's pretty beautiful right now. I don't want to make anybody upset, but I'm looking out into a completely calm Mediterranean Sea, and it's about the perfect weather outside.
Well, it's beautiful outside here, but they're threatening us with Irma Lahara on Friday. And like I said to all those people, if those of you that want to donate to the Red Cross, I did 1,000 times already, quite a bit, 90999 in the text box where it says the number, and in the message box, Harvey or Irma. And I've done that quite a number of times to the Red Cross. It's a $10 donation. It goes on your cell phone bill, and it just helps to let you know that you did something to help the people. And I want to give one more shout-out to my niece, Casey Dallas, who I am so very proud of. She is in Sunrise, Florida. She's an EMT paramedic, and she's working the hurricane. And the mayor of Florida and the head of the fire department, the fire chief, complimented her on her fantastic work, and they're telling her she has to be hunkered down for 3 more days. So I'm excited. I want everybody to have a very wonderful day, and thank you so much. And everyone, have a great day. The sun's shining. And if you don't know what to do, go out and buy a few copies of E.Z. Rinsky's book, a few hundred copies, and Christmas and Hanukkah are coming up, and you can't get them too soon. Have a nice day, and bye.
Bye. Thanks so much.